This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, an update from Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow on the debate over Michigan's energy policy. But first, when Catherine Serpinaugh of Battle Creek died in 2012, the cause of death was originally listed as cancer. But it was complications from chemotherapy, specifically one of the drugs used for her treatment, that caused her death. Now her husband, Ken Serpinaugh, is urging people to learn more about certain types of chemotherapy and the possible complications associated with treatment. Ken Serpinaugh, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Take us through the story of your wife's cancer and her treatment and ultimately her passing away.
Sure. Catherine waited a fair amount of time and waited too long in order to be able to get detected that she had colon cancer, rectal cancer, actually. And when I say waited too long, it was staged ultimately as a borderline stage 3, stage 4. She had sought treatment when she first detected that a lymph node area had swollen up. And so thanks to the medical profession, once she reported that, she got right in. And so that was probably in about the June timeframe of 2012. And I remember on July 6th, she went in for her colonoscopy. And the doctor at that point indicated, sure enough, looks like there was a tumor there. And they were going to report back on Monday, that was a Friday, that what their findings were for sure, to make sure that it was malignant. We did hear that it was malignant. And so then right after that, we saw some oncologists and asked for what the course of treatment would be. Having been down this road before with other family members, we went to one institution locally, and then we went to two others because we wanted a second opinion and actually a third opinion. And so we went to three different institutions in the state of Michigan. And they all agreed about the range of the staging, and they all agreed that there would be three forms of treatment that they would recommend. One would be chemotherapy, secondly, followed with surgery, and then thirdly, with radiation. They varied in terms of what the sequencing might be, but they all prescribed that this would be a chemotherapy that would be what I call 5-FU, or what is really called 5-FU, which is short for fluoropyrimidine, and that would be the treatment. And the institutions recommended that it would be better to start with locally because of the logistics would just work better. And so we did. And Kath wanted to start right away. Once we selected that treatment, then she got right in. Now, one thing that I failed to mention is that at each one of those institutions, of course, we were asking about the chemotherapy. And they indicated that this chemotherapy is fairly well tolerated, as they put it, and that she wouldn't have to worry about losing her hair or other things of that nature. You know, in retrospect, I didn't probe further, and I accepted three different institutions saying that then she should be in pretty good hands. And so we went down that path.
Given that it was stage 3 or perhaps borderline stage 4 mm-hmm. cancer, were you and your wife also thinking that you needed an aggressive form of treatment to get at this? And were you concerned that, you know, again, you need to start right away and it needs to be pretty intense, and therefore perhaps, you know, the side effects you knew might be kind of rough?
Well, we knew that it was at that late stage, and we expected that there would be, as I mentioned, those three forms of treatment, which had she been diagnosed earlier, she might have averted the chemotherapy and the radiation. But at this point in time, the tumor had grown to such an extent that we started with the chemo because the chemo, they hoped, would be able to reduce the size of the tumor, which would lessen what they would have to remove with the surgery. And that they also wanted to make sure that the cancer had not spread further than the one lymph node and the tumor that they knew about. So that's why they started with that. But in terms of the aggressiveness, I wouldn't take that to mean that the strength of the chemotherapy was any greater than what normally they would have offered at any stage where they would have the chemo.
Now, we should also say your wife had, it turned out, a genetic predisposition that did not interact well with this particular type of chemotherapy, correct?
That's true. And it's called DPD deficiency. And for this form of treatment, there needs to be a single enzyme that's produced in order to be able to metabolize the drug. In the absence of that, sufficient levels of that enzyme, then the toxic drug stays in the body and it destroys the healthy cells at the same rate that it destroys the tumorous cells. In extreme cases of this DPD deficiency, people know that. But unless it's a very extreme deficiency, most people are walking around and they may not know this. The medical profession sees that that happens, the genetic predisposition to this is not at a very high rate, and so therefore it's not something that they take into account before the start of treatment. But what I've found and what the medical profession is showing increasingly in medical journals is that there are other factors that play into one's susceptibility to be able to not tolerate that drug as well. And that could be drug interaction. It could just be how the body processes the drug itself. And so what I found is that the response seems to be is that, well, there's a rare genetic condition, and because it's rare, there doesn't seem to be a great demand to do the pre-screening before the start of treatment. But when I look at the numbers, number of severe toxic reactions, genetics alone don't explain it. And when I say the numbers don't add up, it's interesting that there's a range identified in terms of severe toxic reactions. And when I say severe toxic reactions, those will land a patient in a hospital for some extended period of stay. And of course, there's going to be a cost associated with that. And severe toxic reactions, graded 3 and graded 4, will end up with hospitalization. And then in extreme case, such as in Kath's case, can lead to fatalities. Fatalities may only be between 0.5% and 3%. The toxic reactions in total may range anywhere between 10 to 30%. I came across a study by Blue Cross Blue Shield that pegged the number at 30%. And given that, the genetics are well underneath that.
So the genetics can explain part of this, but there has to be something else which
Absolutely.
Explains severe toxic reactions.
Right. The numbers don't add up otherwise. And so I think those are the things that if that same study that Blue Cross Blue Shield had, where they pegged the number at a 30% toxicity rate, they were also looking at genetic testing, and they concluded that genetic testing was not predictive enough, because there's still a lot of study that needs to be done in that area. And so they couldn't rely upon that with a great deal of confidence. And so they didn't indicate that there was enough support for that type of testing. And that's why I think I found that there are two other tests that are out there, well, that are out in use in the world. There is one test that hasn't come on the market yet, but it is, you can discover it on the website, and they will also work with a doctor to provide a service. It's simply called My5FU. What they will do, this company will do, is that they will work with the doctor, and they will take a blood sample and evaluate the effect of the drug on your system, of course, after you've taken the initial test. And that's okay, but I would say that that would only be okay if you have also agreement with your doctor that you should start at a reduced level. Because actually, the preferred way that I would advocate is that there's testing before you even start your first treatment. That would have helped Kath. And that is what two different hospitals in France do. But what the other thing that they do is they test for the activity level of the enzyme. They don't rely upon the genetic tests. And so they're looking for essentially the effectiveness of that enzyme and its presence in order to be able to tolerate and metabolize the chemotherapy. And they have found that by tailoring their dosage, they are also able to still maintain the efficacy level of the drug itself, because that's part of the concern, is that, well, if you dilute it too much, then it's not going to have the desired effect. But they've had success in establishing the proper dosage and still having the ability to minimize the number of toxic reactions.
Have you been learning from other people about this? You have a website which kind of tells Catherine's story. You have another story on there from a young woman who is at this point still recovering correctly from a very serious reaction to 5-FU. And I'm wondering if putting the website out there has perhaps put more people in contact with you who have also experienced something like this with their family.
Well, right about the same time that I was launching the website, which would have been near the end of November of last year, ironically, somebody had reached out to me. And this is a story of Carrie. There's a group that has formed called Strong Mom, and they have strongmom.org, and they're doing what they can to support Carrie's family, because Carrie has three young children. And so she was stricken with this at a much younger age than what Kath was. And she needs a lot of care yet. And so I have not spoken with her husband, but I have been communicating with one of the advocates that they have for supporting that family. And so they've been very supportive. And I like what they're trying to do, because they're not only going to try to support the family, they're doing their part to increase awareness in the area. And that's in the New Jersey, New York community. Then I did also get an email from a young woman who lost her mother, very similarly. And that's out on the West Coast. And so I asked her to share her story. And so, as in my case, I suspect it'll take a little while for her to be able to produce that. I know that when I worked with Kath's oncologist, he asked that I go ahead and write something up on this, because I asked for him to be able to support us on increasing the awareness of this. And so he asked me to, you know, take the first step and synopsize what had happened. And it took a little while. So I suspect this young woman is going to take a little while to be able to process that too. And I hope that other people will learn from this and start to socialize this a little bit more. Because I suspect, as you indicated on there, when we first had her death certificate, it was indicated that she died from cancer. But I asked that it be changed to also indicate that it was as a result of the toxic reaction to the chemotherapy. And the doctor readily agreed he would put that on. So we had two causes of death that are obviously interrelated. And I bring that up because the numbers, which I had gone over earlier, had a relatively low incidence. The numbers may be underreported. And so anybody that faces something like this, I would encourage them to ask the question right away and to make sure that it's reported properly.
You think they may be underreported because if somebody doesn't do what you did and say to the doctor, hey, it's not just cancer, it's cancer plus reaction to the treatment, it may not be on a death certificate someplace.
Correct. And it would not have been in this case had I not done that. And I don't know if that is a source for data collection, but I didn't want to assume that. I thought it would be important in order to be able to do that. And so I wanted it to go on record that that was the immediate cause of death. And interestingly enough, I had not heard of that until Kath had been admitted into the hospital. I had had her taken by ambulance from our home, and then one of the treating physician said, well, this appears to be a case of this sort of deficiency and the toxic reaction to that. And so, okay. So that was the first time I've heard of that. So a little late at that point, because we couldn't really do anything. And when we admitted her, we thought that she was going to still recover. It was just going to take time. But clearly she took a turn for the worse.
So if a family is now facing what you were facing initially, which is cancer, perhaps at a somewhat advanced stage, what would you say that family needs to be asking a doctor about? What are the questions they need to get at in order to have an effective but yet safe treatment?
Well, I guess first of all, I would say is that I'll have to put a plug in here in terms of if they're looking at colorectal cancer, you know, get the tests early so that you don't have to come to this point. Secondly, if you have come to this point, then I would ask the doctor about the course of the chemo treatment, and I would ask them if what the risks are, and share with them that you know that there is a risk than what is commonly believed, and that you want to have that open discussion with the doctor about what might contribute to that, and how the doctor would encourage managing that risk. And in this case here, in particular, I would say what they can do in one of two things. Evaluate them beforehand to find out what the risk level may be, whether it's a genetic test, or ultimately we get down the road, we can get this functional test that I had mentioned earlier about testing the actual enzyme activity level, which is the optimal in my opinion. Short of that, then I would say encourage them to start at a reduced level. Start at a reduced level and then assess the effectiveness of the drug and the patient's ability in order to be able to tolerate that. And then adjust in increments accordingly. That's what I would suggest.
Before we wrap up, we talked a lot about your wife's medical condition and how she passed away. I would just like to give you the opportunity, if you'd care to take it, to tell us maybe a little bit more about her, how you'd like to remember her, how you'd like her to be remembered.
Well, first of all, she was a very giving person, and I think a lot of people in the community recognize that. So there was a loss in the community, and our family had a lot of support. They were touched. They were taken aback because they were unaware that she was sick. And then within a matter of a few weeks, she had passed away. And so a lot of people were stricken by that. And I found that I was having to provide a lot of support to those people as they were coming up because they were just in shock. I had some idea, and so I was able to process that. That didn't make it easy.
Right.
But actually trying to help friends through that process was helpful. But back to the caring point, she cared a lot about people, and she cared a lot about the environment, and she cared also about, in this case here, what you would say, the body of learning. And so one of the things that I come across that she had written up, she was keeping essentially a blog as she'd started to go down this path. And one of the entries in her blog talked about her thanks to the people that have gone down this road before her that would help, that had helped up to that point in time, contribute to the body of learning, which would then enable her to receive the type of treatment that she would receive. And so there had to be pioneers in order to be able to provide advancement in that area. And what I would like to think here is that Kath's experience would be another page in that book, so to speak, to help the education of the public and the care providers so that this too can contribute to the body of learning so that we can get better outcomes for anybody that's faced with this sort of situation. And I think that's how she would like to be remembered. And that's what I'm trying to do in honoring her in doing this.
Ken Serpernaw, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
You can find a link to Ken Serpernaw's website about the risks of 5-FU chemotherapy at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The state's energy policy is one of the debates ongoing at the state capitol. Lawton Representative Eric Nesbitt has proposed changes which have drawn criticism from environmentalists for keeping the renewable portfolio standard at its current level. Some conservatives have criticized the plan put forward by Nesbitt, who's chairman of the House Energy Policy Committee, because it would completely regulate the utility market, as opposed to allowing the current 10% cap for alternative suppliers. We're going to talk energy with Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow. Zach, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Gordon.
How big a role does the state actually play in regulating energy policy?
Oh, it's huge. You're talking about oversight of rates, oversight of how billing is handled, what percentage of energy has to come from renewable sources, what utilities have to do as far as energy efficiency, how much of the market is controlled by the incumbent utilities, which would be utilities like Consumers Energy, and how much is available to competition. I mean, it's a very, very significant presence.
So let's break down a little bit who might be on what sides of the proposals that Eric Nesbitt has put forward. Who would like to see more competition and who would like to see a completely regulated market?
Well, on the side of more competition tends to be, as we would expect, would be companies that would like to enter the Michigan market and sell power to customers. Libertarians, free market conservatives have long pushed for more competition. Right now, under Michigan law, only 10% of the market is subject to competition. The rest is assured of going to the incumbent utilities in the particular territory. So, as you might expect, those who would like to see less competition or substantial change in how the current system works are the utilities like Consumers Energy, DTE Energy. They would like to see the state go back to what's called a fully regulated system where there is no competition. Other companies cannot compete for customers. Failing that, they would like to see measures put into place that they say would require the competing companies to do more to assure that there's enough capacity available. The competing companies will tell you that that's a red herring. They're already doing that, but that's sort of the lay of the land on that issue.
Then there's the renewable portfolio standard. In other words, how much of the energy has to come from renewable sources. Representative Nesbitt has said he wants to keep it where it's at. There's been some calls to boost it, and some other people have said we should just get rid of it altogether. Who are on the sides of that issue? Who would like to see a higher renewable portfolio standard, and who would like to see it kept the same or even scrapped?
Well, as far as going to a higher standard, you're talking about environmental activists. The Democrats all want to see the standard increased. Right now, it's 10% of all energy has to come from renewable sources. It tends to be mainly in Michigan wind. You drive up north, especially places like Gratiot County or the Thumb, you're going to see a lot of windmills or wind profile devices harnessing energy. You know, they would like to see, I believe, something in the neighborhood of 22% by a year certain. But then you've got the utilities saying, you know, that's unnecessary. The federal government, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's new standards regarding emissions from power plants is naturally going to cause the retirement of coal-fired power plants. And thus, utilities are going to have to use more renewable sources, more natural gas for power, and that's going to have the same effect without a mandate. At this point, there would probably be no point in just getting rid of the 10% standard because it's not like I don't see utilities deciding to get rid of the investments they made to get to 10%. So, you know, keeping it at 10% is really tantamount to just, you know, status quo. There really would be no difference between that and getting rid of it, at least in the short and medium term.
So despite these proposals which have come out, we've heard a lot of debate back and forth. There's been a couple hearings where some pointed questions were asked. But you advise us on the Gongwer News Service blog that there is a path with minimal change visible. Why is that the case?
Well, I think it's because really the major issue that seems to have some different points of view between the Republican majorities in the legislature and the governor is this competition question. There's really very little support for going back to full competition, where the competing companies can come in and fight for every customer. Eric Nesbitt, the energy chair in the House, wants to go to, you know, full control for the utilities, no competition. But the governor and Senator Mike Noss, the Republican from Battle Creek, who chairs the Senate Energy Committee, have been very resistant to that idea. I think their concern is that would mean forcing customers who have chosen choice, are using a different company, to switch. And I think there's some reticence about doing that. So if you're, you know, you look at it, you have the governor and the Senate on one side, potentially. I think it's going to put the House, you know, with Eric Nesbitt in a difficult spot, you know, trying to, you know, get through two of the proverbial three legs of the stool. And then when you look at the other really big piece that people have talked about, which is the renewable power standard, there just seems to be among, you know, the governor, Senator Nofs, Representative Nesbitt, an agreement that there's no need to increase the standard. So given that, there simply may not be any kind of a change there. Now, Senator Nofs has talked about going to a clean energy standard, which would, you know, potentially, he hasn't spelled it out yet or introduced a bill, incorporate natural gas and maybe, he hasn't said this yet, set a percentage of energy that would have to come from clean sources. Now, if he does that, that would potentially set the stage for a major change. But, you know, right now you've got Representative Nesbitt and the governor basically just saying leave the 10% standard alone. So you could see very little change on that potentially.
There's an interesting mix in play here, Zach. Representative Eric Nesbitt is not known as a moderate Republican. Out of these three Republicans we're talking about, Governor Snyder, Mike Nofs, and Eric Nesbitt, Nesbitt's the one who probably would least be associated or would be least likely to be called a moderate Republican. Do we have a good idea of why he has come out in favor of a fully regulated market or doesn't seem to be wild anyway about greater competition amongst the utilities?
Well, you know, those who argue for this point of view see a capacity problem coming for the state. And, you know, there does appear to be, you know, in a few, you know, 2 years that the reserve margin of power is going to start dropping because you are going to have a number of coal plants being retired. And I think Nesbitt's point of view basically is that can't be allowed to happen. Let's let the, you know, people like DTE and consumers that handle the lion's share of power generation in the state, you know, put them in the position to do what they need to do to be able to afford those kinds of investments. It is, you know, he's obviously in general a pretty free market conservative guy, Representative Nesbitt, but this would be an exception to that, clearly.
So we mentioned what you told us earlier, that the path for minimal change is visible. At this point, would you say that is the most likely outcome?
I do. You know, I can't really predict what's going to happen here because we don't have Senator Nofs' proposal yet, but he has reacted to some of the things that are out there, and he's certainly given an indication of what he thinks should happen on some of these things. But I do think, you know, we're likely to see, you know, certainly no change in the renewable portfolio standard. I think the question is, does Senator Nofs come up with a clean energy standard that says, I'm just going to throw a number out there, 30% of all energy has to come from clean sources, and that can be natural gas, renewables, and other things by a date certain? Or does it end up just being, let's let the utilities do this on the timetable they think makes sense, which I think is where the momentum is right now. The utilities seem to be, and when I say utilities, I mean the biggies like consumers and DTE, basically are saying, look, we've got the federal government pushing these things already. There's no reason to layer in a state mandate on top of us. You know, we're going to be producing more energy with natural gas. We're going to be producing more with wind. You know, the environmentalists are suspicious of this. You know, certainly you wonder if there is a change in party in the presidency after 2016, you wonder what might happen with some of these EPA regulations that don't fully take effect until 2030. But that said, I do think the momentum seems to be on the side of let the utilities give them the flexibility they need to respond to the federal regulations as they see fit.
Zach Gorchow, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Zach Gorchow is the editor of the Gongra News Service. Links with more information, extended versions of interviews on West Southwest, and past programs can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.